Ivan and Flymed were the first medical device company here.
Back in the 70s,
back in the 70s, right? So who the heck do we go and get? And I said, you know, I didn't get here till 1988, so my history with that company was more when it was, I think it was Alaris at the time. And I don't know any of those guys from the 70s. So we went to the UCSD library archives. Read about IVAC and IMED. Now, unfortunately, the guy who founded it, I forget his name now, Richard Craven, I think, something like that, passed away about 4 years ago. So you can't get him. But there were a lot of names mentioned in there. So it's good. We could track down some of those guys and get them to show up, hopefully. It's a good source, good resource.
Well, this will be an oral history. We'll go in their archive and be available to history of biomedical sciences and biomedical industry. And so it's actually important stuff.
Great.
So we're recording it. We want to get your story, so maybe we can just start at the beginning.
Where do you want to start?
Well, tell me just about your family, your background, education, start early years.
Well, I grew up in Syracuse, New York, and went to high school and college there. And when I graduated from high school, I planned on going to medical school. So I went to school at a very good, small Jesuit college in Syracuse called Le Moyne College that had a great reputation for students entering medical school. But by the time that I had gotten to my senior year, I had lost interest in medical school and didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I graduated and kind of thought, well, I'll work for a couple of years and decide what I want to do from there. And I got a job with a very large dairy products company based in Syracuse. And they were starting their, believe it or not, this company had been around for 50 years, and they were starting their first quality control laboratory. They'd never had a quality control laboratory before, so.
So this is also back in late 70s,
Yeah,
I don't think we had that company on.
It's called, yeah, it's not on there. I don't even put it on there anymore, but it was a company called Byrne Dairy, B-Y-R-N-E, Byrne Dairy Products, started way back in the, I think the early 20s by a family, the Byrne family in Syracuse. So I don't know what they were thinking, but you know, they hired me fresh out of Le Moyne College with my biology degree to start their quality control laboratory. And
that's a great opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know the first thing about quality control or dairy products, or I mean, about the only thing that I did know was that Le Moyne had given me was a very good practical grounding in working in the laboratory. We spent a good balanced amount of time in class and in the lab, something that today has given me a real appreciation here in San Diego for a good practical training in the biosciences in our schools here.
So you're thinking in terms of cultivating a workforce for this industry.
You know, cultivating a workforce that can come out of school, and especially the students with a four-year science degrees who are able to hit the ground running, function in a laboratory. You know, it's not all book learning, book science. They actually know how to use laboratory equipment. And a lot of our companies really appreciate that. So I won't name schools. But some are good at it, and some are not so good at it, and are improving all the time.
So that's your start. You had...
Yeah, so I went to work in this laboratory and had a great time purchasing such primitive equipment as test tubes and just really basic stuff back then. And so I did that for about a year and a half, and all of that time was thinking, you know, I don't want to work in a dairy lab for the rest of my life in Syracuse, New York.
Were you working with regulators?
I was working with the New York State regulators, and I actually had a milk tester's license that I had to study for and take a test for, and so I was a certified New York State milk tester at the time. I don't know where that would have led me in terms of a future career, but I actually had an offer before I left to go back to school. I had an offer from someone who did some of our testing for us, our overload testing for us on the side, and he said, why don't you stay here and come into a partnership with me on the lab and you can help me to build the business. I'm not sure if that would have been a good idea, because when I look at the dairy business today and, you know, the efficiencies that we've created through biotech, in a lot of ways, things like BST, that's another part of my story, mm-hmm. that kind of work probably isn't as lucrative as it was back when we'd collect milk farm by farm and test it farm by farm. We had 75 dairy farms at Burn Dairy. Today, I got on their website, today they have about 12. So that's what efficiency has done. And they produce much more milk than they did back then. So anyway, it became a matter of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I had kind of this dual interest, scientific research, and I began to become more interested in the environment. And back in the late 70s, the environment was becoming a matter of very grave concern because of damage from things like acid rain and pesticides in the environment. And, I mean, every day you'd see a story in the paper.
I guess especially upstate New York, that's acid rain country,
right? Up there, yeah. And also manufacturing country, steel mills and chemical manufacturing plants. Mm-hmm. So I applied to graduate school, and I applied to a couple of schools to go on and get a PhD in research, and a couple of schools to study environmental science.
Where did you get the PhD idea? Where did that come from?
It came out of, the reason I didn't go to medical school was that I had worked in a hospital, and I loved the patient interaction. But what I was seeing more in the hospital was that doctors were becoming so reliant on tests, and I worked in the lab in the hospital part-time as well, that I thought medicine was going too much in the direction of technology and not so much in the direction of patient interaction, and that wasn't for me. And so I decided I didn't want to do that. But I was still interested in the human aspect of it, I guess you'd say. And so I applied to a couple of schools and got into a couple of schools to go and get a PhD in human anatomy. And then I applied to a couple of schools in the environmental health arena. And got in and I kind of weighed the two. And my then fiance, now wife, who's also a biology major and actually became a laboratory researcher herself, said to me, I don't know what kind of a future there is in studying human anatomy, but I bet you there's more of a future in environmental health and environmental science. And I kind of took that as a signal. You know, if we're going to get married, maybe you ought to think about something that you can support us on. So then I got into a couple of schools and a bunch of schools, actually, and was thinking about going to the University of Michigan. Had a great program at the University of Michigan, and drove out there to see it. It was a two-year MSPH program in water quality, and thought this was okay, but we looped through Pittsburgh on the way back because I had also gotten into the Graduate School of Public Health in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Looped through there and talked to the people in the School of Public Health, and they gave me this real sense of being connected to some of the real practical problems in environmental health in Pittsburgh, which, of course,
is a steel city,
Alcoa, U.S. Steel, Gulf Oil. And I saw that a lot of the lecturers at the school were folks who were professionals in those various corporations as well. So I thought Michigan's great, got a great reputation. But I think I'll get a more practical education at Pitt. So I went to school at University of Pittsburgh, and 2 years got my degree in public health, my master's in public health with a concentration on environmental and industrial health science. Mm-hmm. And I had another decision to make. My program in industrial and occupational health was kind of a dual degree in the sense that I had training in occupational health and I had training in environmental health. I could have gone in two directions. I could have gone, into a manufacturing environment on the industrial environmental side, human exposure in manufacturing and that kind of thing, or I could go to more of the environmental side, water quality, air quality, those kinds of things. And I actually was made an offer to go to work at the Allegheny County Health Department on the environmental side. And I thought, well, this is great, but something in me said, I want to do something more on the large policy level. So I got in the car one day out of the blue in August, my final year, and I drove down to Washington, D.C., drove down to EPA. Now, this was 1979, so you could literally walk into any government building in D.C. Mm-hmm. without having to show any ID, without having to go through a scanner, nothing. Mm-hmm. So I walked into EPA, and I actually just started knocking on some doors and said, I'm looking for a job. And actually knocking on doors in the water quality program because my concentration in environmental health had been in water quality. Mm-hmm. And EPA was hiring like gangbusters back in 1979. I mean, they had
Three Mile Island.
Oh my gosh,
all kinds
Three Mile
of things
Island,
going.
And yeah. I don't know if we had Hooker Chemical and the incident up in Buffalo, New York. I forget what that was now, with all the buried chemicals. But
right,
all the big environmental laws were being passed: the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act. They were just hiring up like gangbusters. And I was given an offer in the water program, but it was a one-year temporary job, and they said, don't worry, it'll convert over to a permanent job. But as I was walking out, just complete serendipity, I ran into a woman who ran a part of the program in pesticides and toxic substances, and she said, well, we've got full-time jobs because we're not as glamorous as water. And they're a pay grade higher than the water jobs. And I said, sign me up. I don't know anything about pesticides, but I'll learn. Mm-hmm. So I went to work at the EPA in the Pesticides and Toxic Substances group and was part of an incredible group that for the first time was reviewing all of these different kinds of chemical pesticides that had been approved over 50 years by the Department of Agriculture with almost no data at all, because that was the way it used to be done. Mm-hmm. And I ended up running teams of scientists and environmental toxicologists, environmental scientists, economists, industrial hygienists to review the health risks of all these various pesticides and to make decisions on what was needed from the manufacturers in the way of data, whether they were enough of a threat to workers or the environment that certain uses ought to be pulled off the label, making recommendations to our assistant administrator on all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then ended up working on one that was incredibly, incredibly controversial, called ethylene dibromide or EDB, that was being used to fumigate citrus that was being shipped to places like Japan to disinfest it of the eggs laid by the Mediterranean fruit fly, which was an issue out here in California. Mm-hmm. And that became such a big issue that I ended up in meetings at the White House with policymakers over there because citrus fruit was such a huge market for the U.S. And I got more exposed to that kind of policy and ended up then looking for a job in the policy office at EPA. Spent 2 years as a senior policy analyst in that office working on pesticides and toxic substances policy overall for the agency. And 5 years of that,
Tell me just a little bit about the substance of that work. How's you know, how was the policy formulated? What's the process?
The process was basically to take a look for the, so the agency at that time was about 12 years old. Policy making was kind of a foreign thing to the agency at the time. They were so busy trying to implement laws that they weren't really focused on what their policies should be from an implementation standpoint. You know, in other words, what was their policy going to be on the number of permits that they wanted to issue for new drinking water plants, and what was their policy going to be on turning over responsibility to the states for managing these various laws? So the substance of that work was literally to, for the first time, set up a system under which we would measure and report out and work with our regional offices on implementation of all of these different laws and regulations in a way that we could actually measure our progress and report back to the president on our progress. It was very controversial in the program offices because no one had ever made them do any of this before. And so it was kind of a free-for-all in the program offices. Just do whatever you want to do. Come to work every day. Nobody ever asked you what you did. Nobody asked you how much of it you did. Nobody asked you what your plan was to turn it over to anybody else. Well, when I went to work for Ann Gorsuch, the administrator at the time, and we began to implement these programs, the folks who had been there for a while got pretty ticked off. And then my boss ran into some issues around some of her assistants who were less than above board about some of the meetings they were having with industry. She didn't hire any of those folks. They were all given to her as political appointees. And so she was finally kind of forced to leave the agency. And after she left, that was the end of what we were doing on policy. And after she left, I decided it was time for me to leave too. Mm-hmm. So my wife was a researcher at the Red Cross Blood Research Lab in Washington. She was working on a test for a new type of hepatitis that had been detected that they were calling non-A, non-B hepatitis at the time. Of course, now we know it as hepatitis C. And she said to me, you know, we want to have kids, but I feel really uncomfortable coming to work in a hepatitis research lab every day if we're going to have kids. And I said, well, I want to leave EPA, so maybe it's time for me to go get some experience on the corporate side. So I looked around, and I had all this experience interfacing with my program office folks at EPA, and the ideal opportunity that came up was to go to work for a chemical company and kind of be on the other side of the fence. Mm-hmm. So I took a job as a manager of regulatory affairs for a company called Penwalt Corporation in Philadelphia. Penwalt, at that time, was probably more than 100 years old. It originally had been called the Pennsylvania Salt Company, so that's how far back their history went. But by then, they were just a very diverse group of companies that made everything from centrifuges to piezoelectric film to agricultural chemicals to dental equipment. I mean, incredibly diverse.
Conglomerate,
yep. Great opportunity to go to work in a 10,000 people Fortune 100 company, and I decided to take the job and go there. And my wife at the same time got a job with what was then called ICI Americas, their pharmaceuticals division, now called AstraZeneca, and she became a clinical data analyst with AstraZeneca. We lived in Wilmington, and I commuted up to Philadelphia every day to go to work at Penwalt, which was great. It was a great opportunity. Worked for a global company, gave me great management experience, gave me a great opportunity to understand working with regulators from the industry side, and great management in the company. Um, one day I got a call from the research folks at Penn Walton, and they said, we'd like some help from you on the regulatory side in Washington because we're doing some experiments with bacteria and trying to grow up bacteria in a fermenter to see if we could potentially use these bacteria to produce proteins, and that's the next big thing. And they said, but we don't know much about the containment rules. We don't know much about...
Is recombinant proteins?
They weren't recombinant yet, but they were thinking about how they could get into recombinant proteins. I started to work with them a little bit, and we got to the point where we needed to get senior management approval to begin to work with recombinant organisms. Because they said, you know, we understand fermentation, and, you know, we want to move to the next step. So we went to make a presentation to the president and the chief operating officer, or the CEO and the president and chief operating officer. I went with them because I had to explain, you know, the safety issues. And we made this presentation about how we thought biology could really benefit Penwalt Corporation in the future and that this was the next big thing. These two folks were chemical engineers. They're probably, I'm guessing they were 60 years old at the time. And they looked at us and they said, gentlemen, Penwalt Corporation is a chemical company. We don't do biology here. So I thought, well, gee, that's not very...
Not very forward-looking.
Forward-looking, that's not very futuristic. But okay, you know, I've got a good job. I'll go back and do my job. And... about a month or two later, just out of the blue, I got a call from a recruiter who I knew. And in passing one time, I had mentioned to him that we were working on this. And he called and said, hey, you know, I'm working with a company called Mycogen Corporation out in San Diego. And they need a regulatory person. And they're working with... growing up microbes in the fermenter to produce proteins. Mm-hmm. Didn't you say you were interested in that stuff? And I said, yeah, absolutely interested in it.
I've got a Elf Atochem here.
Well, they became Penwalt became Elf Atochem.
I see. All right.
They were acquired by ELF in France, and they became.
Okay.
That's what they are today still.
So Mycogen was looking for...
Mycogen was looking, you know, little old fledgling Mycogen.
2 years old at that time, yeah.
5 years old.
5 years old.
5 years old was not even 5 years old, probably. Yeah. They knew they were doing something really tricky because they had a bacterial organism, Pseudomonas fluorescens, that they were creating a recombinant organism with by taking the protein that it comes out of a Bacillus thuringiensis that was traditionally from the 40s used as a topical spray insecticide, but not very effective when you're up against, you know, the hardcore organochlorine types of insecticides. But it was becoming more popular because of the environmental issues around pesticide use. Of course, I had that experience in working at EPA. And he said, you know, they really want to talk to you. So I said, okay, where are they? San Diego. I said, where is that? Somewhere in Southern California, I go to Sacramento a lot. Where is San Diego? South of Los Angeles somewhere? Yeah. Down on the Mexican border? Yeah. I said, all right, I have to be in Sacramento in a couple of weeks. I'll fly down and talk to them, which is exactly what I did. And I'll never forget the conversation I had with these folks. I'd never talked to anyone in a biotech company before, the first time. And here I was coming out of a Fortune 100, you know, back then maybe $3 billion in sales chemical mm-hmm. company. 10,000 people, well-established in Philadelphia and around the world. And I said to the CEO, Jerry Calder, now tell me, if you can, please, so that I can understand this. What's your business model? And he said, well, we're going to produce the first genetically engineered pesticides. They're going to replace a whole class of chemical pesticides. The plan is to have these commercial within 3 years. And at the time, he said the plan is for the company to be profitable by, I think, 1995. Of course, all biotech companies are going to be profitable within 5 or 6 years, right?
Sure.
So I said, well, what are your revenues right now? And he said, well, our revenues are really the revenues that we receive from the company had gone public the year before I got there. So, you know, from our stock sales and our investors. He said, we've got $18 million in the bank, and that should last us at least a year. And he said that like we're in fine shape. We've got a year of capital in the bank. And I said, well, what happens after that? He said, we issue more stock. We raise more money. And I said, huh, that's an interesting model. So, but I was intrigued with the technology, and I was intrigued, at, you know, as I had been at Penwald Corporation, with the idea that there was the potential to create this new class of environmentally friendly pesticides. Mm-hmm. And we went back and forth for about a month, and I decided to take the job.
So you had to assess the risk, kind of balance the risk. Did you have to sell it to your wife? What were your deliberations like?
I went back and I told my wife about this, and she said, wow, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But they invited us both back out here for a weekend. Mm-hmm. And we came back out and spent the weekend on the beach and enjoying the 72-degree weather in San Diego while it was 95 degrees with 95% humidity back in Wilmington. Mm-hmm. And we went back, and my wife actually said to me, maybe we should think about this. And she said something funny. She said what a lot of people who come out here say to me now. She said, you know what, do it for a couple of years and we'll come back. Just go out and enjoy the beach out in California for a couple of years. I mean, she and I both had grown up in Syracuse. I went to Le Moyne. She went to Syracuse University. We met working in the hospital lab together. You know, we were East Coasters, and so we thought, well, this would just be a kind of a fun little diversion for a couple of years. So,
it could work, though, right? You think?
Oh yeah, we didn't know where it was going to go, but we thought we could always come back. And I have to say, you know, at the same time, I thought this technology is incredibly promising. If we can make this work, this could be a huge thing. So, so we came out here in 1988, and the first thing that we did at Micogen was we had a challenge on our hands. The microbes that we were growing in the fermenter that produced the recombinant protein were then going to be released into the environment as a formulated pesticide product, but as a live organism. And things were happening in places like Monterey, where ordinances were being passed where you couldn't release genetically modified organisms into the environment. So we had a problem. And we didn't know what we were going to do about it. Until one of our scientists, Frank Gartner, and our one of our founders, Andy Barnes, came up with an ingenious idea. They said, you know, what if we kill these organisms, the protein, and keep the protein intact? We can still use them for the same intended purpose. And they came up with the idea of using an iodine fixative that would kill the cells, and the iodine fixative also acted to harden the cell wall. So we kind of got a double benefit out of it in the sense that it took care of the environmental question of releasing live organisms, but it also created a product that would last longer on a leaf surface because of the hardened cell wall.
So the bugs are going to consume it and then break down the cell.
Yeah.
Okay.
The problem with BT as a natural product is it typically only lasts on a leaf surface for a couple of days. So if you don't catch the bugs in the right stage of their life cycle, mm-hmm. it doesn't work. But this product could last for 14 days. So it would last through the various cycles of growth of the insects. So we got approval. It was not easy because we had to do a lot of the same kinds of tests that you would do for chemical pesticides. But we didn't have to do any of the long-term toxicity tests that take years.
Yeah, so when Mycogen first talked to you, I mean, they came to you because they saw this problem looming, and you were brought in to solve this problem?
Yeah, they saw this problem. The problem that they saw was they didn't know the first thing about taking products like this to EPA to ask for approval.
Sure. So nobody did, right?
Because nobody did. But they knew that I had been there, and they knew that I knew the whole agricultural chemicals regulatory world from my time at Penwald. So they really kind of took a chance on me, and I took a chance on them, was what it came down to. So I was brought in to figure out how to get these things approved and to get them approved. So we began to do the testing around 1989. It took us a little over a year. Made the submission of all the data to the pesticides group at EPA. They had to be satisfied that we, in fact, had a process that would kill all these organisms and that there wouldn't be any that would escape into the environment. So we had to prove that. Of course, because they were proteins and they broke down and there wasn't any concern about chronic toxicity, cancer, or any of those things, we didn't have to do any of the typical tests that you have to do on a pesticide. So it only took us about a year to get the data package together. But by 1991, we had approval, and we began to sell the product. And it was actually, the sales went pretty well. There's only one problem. By 1991, a company called Monsanto was already beginning to take the genetic sequence that we were putting into the bacterium to express the protein to spray out onto corn crops and cotton. They were already inserting it into the seeds themselves and getting the plant to express it on its own. So we realized we better shift gears pretty quickly.
And but that was still, at that time, it must have been still a long way off before it improved. I mean, you could get into the market and still, you know, get 5 to 10 years, right?
We thought. But Jerry Calder, our CEO, and Al Kern, who was my boss at the time, who ran commercial development, said, you know, Joe, you better go learn more about what it's going to take to get these genetically engineered seeds approved, because we might find ourselves going in that direction. So I went to meetings in Washington and you know, wherever there were meetings being held on the planning the process for doing the various tests that would be required to get those kinds of products approved. And in the meantime, we bought a couple of seed companies that had some great technologies in Texas and in Wisconsin, particularly one in Wisconsin in Madison called Jake's Seeds, that had a laboratory that was working with the same kinds of things that Monsanto was working with. In fact, they had also acquired a company that had this technology themselves that Monsanto had been working with as well. Before Monsanto acquired the technology, which is another story because we ended up in court over the whole thing with Monsanto, and in the end we won a $375 million judgment over who actually owned the technology. And it turned out that
was it patents? Or
it was patents. It was over patents and who owned the patents. We went on then from that point around 1991 to beginning to work on genetically engineered seeds using some of the same sequences that we had.
Yeah, I have a question. Where did that technology, it was Jake's, is that what you said?
It was Jake's, and it was a couple of small companies also that Jake's had acquired, and I'm not sure, they're small seed companies in the Midwest.
Yeah, did they get the technology out of some university? Did they get the molecular biologists?
I'm not really sure.
I can look at the patents.
Yeah, I'm not sure where they got it from, but they owned it. And they had some great scientists in a lab in Madison, Wisconsin, who were working with it.
Yeah.
And So we kind of got into this race, and we teamed up with what's now Syngenta, and what was then Novartis Seeds. Teamed up with them, and also teamed up with a very well-established corn seed company in Iowa, Pioneer Seeds, to commercialize the technology. Mm-hmm. And just went into an all-out race to do the regulatory work, the field trials, everything we needed to put together a business around genetically engineered crops. And by 1994, we were ready to go to the federal government to ask for approval, about the same time Monsanto was. So we...
Well, how did you feel about this race? Because you're under-resourced, seriously, in comparison to Monsanto, I would assume.
Yeah, we were. It was David and Goliath, and we enjoyed it. It was fun. It was fun from the standpoint that it was all for one and one for all, great camaraderie within the company. Our CEO created a great environment
Is it Jerry?
It was Jerry, yeah. It was hard work, and at the same time, we did a lot of things to come together and have some fun. And we all enjoyed each other's company for the most part. You know, there are always a little social issues within any biotech company, but for the most part, we had a great time. And I mean, we were there from 7 in the morning to 10 at night sometimes. We were working hard, and we knew who the opposition was as well, and we were all in it to win the race, or at least to come in at the same time. Mm-hmm. So we did. We ended up doing what we had to do, working with Novartis and Pioneer, who were, you know, great partners for us. By 1995, we had obtained approval for our genetically modified seeds.
Ahead of Monsanto?
Same time. They came out literally within a week of each other. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then it was, you know, off to compete with each other. But we realized our new CEO, Jerry, after we got that approval, decided to kind of back off and do some investing and some other things. And Carl Eibel became our CEO. Carl had been our general counsel. And Carl said, you know, he and a few other folks, Jeff Guys over at Wilson Sonsini, and a few other patent lawyers looked at the patents and said, you know, we think we own this technology, not Monsanto. And had the guts to say, we're going to sue them. And we did. And we took them to court, and it was a battle here in San Diego in U.S. District Court, and we won. We won the patent battle and a $375 million judgment.
But again, this is a very risky thing to do, because Monsanto, they could string this thing out, and what was your strategy for...
Strategy was to hire the best, hardest working outside patent lawyers we could find. And that's what we did. And we set up a war room where we spent, you know, day and night putting together our case. Monsanto, of course, sent in their lawyers in their $2,000 suits, who kind of thought they'd make us look like fools. And basically the opposite happened. We ended up with the rights. So here we were, kind of the cat that ate the canary. And by 1997 or so, we were drawing the attention of some folks at one of Monsanto's rivals, Dow AgroSciences, and the Dow Chemical Company. And for two reasons. The Dow Chemical Company was interested in our fermentation technology, which we had literally put on the shelf because we were working with the seeds. The Dow AgroSciences folks were interested in the seed business because they too saw that as a wave of the future. Mm-hmm. So we began working with them more, and by 1998, they made our board and our shareholders an offer to acquire the company. And I was on the senior management team by then. I was a corporate VP, and you know, we decided that the offer that they made was one that we wanted to take, and we went along with it. It was good. It was good for the shareholders. I mean, by that point, Micogen was 15 years old, you know, still not profitable. A lot of investment had been made in growing the company. By that point, we had about 600 employees, about $250 million in business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it was a good time to sell for the benefit of the shareholders who had waited so long and invested so much in the company. So we sold the company to Dow AgroSciences, and so part of the business went to Midland, Michigan, the fermentation business, and the other part of the business went to Indianapolis, where their AgroSciences group was based. Mm-hmm. And within a year, they asked me to move there, and I had. After they acquired us, they'd given me a great position as global leader of government affairs in their biotech group. Great opportunity for the future.
And that was because they were just getting started in
yes.
biotech, and they really didn't have it all put together yet.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I took the job, but what I found within a year was that going to Dow AgroSciences was almost like going back to Penwalt in the sense that it was a large corporation. Mm-hmm. And I found myself constantly in meetings. And I found myself kind of, I thought, kind of boxed in terms of the decisions that I could make on my own that I'd been able to make on my own at
sure.
Micogen before. So at the end of a year, They also said, we want you to move to Indianapolis, and I said, I don't think that's what I want to do. So within about 2 or 3 months, Jerry Calder and some of the folks on the Biocom board came to me and said, you know, Biocom is a great organization, and I knew Biocom because at the time we housed Biocom at Micogen. Biocom's
right?
offices were at Micogen.
And, so Jerry was involved in organizing.
Yeah. Jerry, David Hale, Bill Rastetter, Dwayne Roth, David Robinson. You know, it was some of the early folks in biotech here.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked me if I'd come and take over. And the reason was that while Biocom at that time was about 4 or 5 years old, it was essentially a great networking group for local companies and CEOs. And it had been very successful in beginning to develop relationships with city government, the permitting department downtown, the fire warden, you know, anybody locally who had anything to do with helping to streamline the process of constructing biotech facilities. But they realized that they needed to have more advocacy interface in places like Sacramento and Washington. And I had had that experience both by being in Washington and by working at places like Micogen and Penwalt. And I didn't want to leave. I mean, so, you know, I looked at my wife, Karen, and I said, I don't know the first thing about running a trade association. I've been active in trade associations like Bio and at the time, it wasn't even called Bio. It was called the Industrial Biotechnology Association and Biocom. But I don't know anything about running a trade association. And at the same time, we said, you know what? If we want to stay in San Diego, we better jump on the opportunity because there doesn't seem to be much else for a guy who understands ag biotech in a town that's developing drugs. So I said, all right. I'll take the job.
That was important to stay in San Diego. You settled here. You like it.
Oh, we loved it here.
Yeah.
Our kids were just starting high school. Our daughter was just starting high school. Our son was just starting middle school.
Yeah, it's a tough time to move kids.
Yeah. And we loved being here. You know, we had pretty much become immersed in San Diego, so we didn't really want to leave.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you've been here since mid-'80s or late?
1988.
88, okay. So, I mean, you know, still there have been a lot of growth in the local industry.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe could you just talk about your observations of what your sense of what was going on here and how it was taking place?
Well, you know, one of the things that there were one or two other guys who did regulatory work here when I came here. And one of the things we always used to talk about was, where are we going to go if our companies fold? Because at that time, there weren't a lot of biotech companies here, and there weren't a lot of jobs in regulatory affairs because so many companies were early-stage research biotech companies and weren't even thinking about clinical trials or anything that would involve regulatory work at the time. My other hat at Micogen was that I ran facilities, environmental health and safety, all of our quality assurance as well, so which was not a small job. So I could have stayed on that side probably and looked for a job in that area. But back in the late 80s, early 90s, it was hard to recruit people here because the industry was still very much in its infancy, and the concern was, A, it was incredibly expensive to come here, buy a house. You know, we had a house in Wilmington, Delaware. It was a 2,200-square-foot house that we had paid $85,000 for a couple of years before. And to buy anything close to work, even back in 1988, that size was about $350,000. I mean, people aren't going to make four times what they're making back mm-hmm. there, so it was tough. But the industry itself back then, we were still kind of celebrating the success of Hybertech, which, you know, had been sold to Lilly by then. It was one of the first companies to actually produce a biotech product, the PSA test for prostate cancer that they commercialized back in the late 70s, 1980. There were some companies that were well along in clinical trials, but back then it was still tough to raise money. Mm-hmm. I've heard this story a bunch of times from Bill Rastetter about how IDEC literally was out of cash until he made a phone call to someone at Genentech to fuel the company through getting their approval of their Rituxan product. So it was really kind of a touch and go wild time for the industry here, it's also a time when we didn't yet have the experienced senior management folks and CEOs that we now refer to as the group of serial CEOs and serial entrepreneurs, but there wasn't any serial yet to be had back then.
Right.
So not a lot of experience. Mm-hmm. And yet San Diego was becoming, back then, one of the big centers of biotech in the country. And yet Boston and San Francisco back then were more well-known as biotech centers than San Diego was. I think it would be fair to say that back in the late 90s, for the most part, we were here kind of working in a very insular way to develop the biotech industry here. Not a lot of connections outside of San Diego.
Yeah. And there was not a lot of capital here.
No, the capital was all up in San Francisco. There were only one or two venture firms here, primarily Forward Ventures that Ivor Royston started after Hybertech, and Enterprise Ventures that Drew Senier had started that was more focused on investment in medical devices. In some ways, back then, the medical device industry was probably as large as the biotech industry here as well.
So you have a lot of docs at UCSD inventing things.
Yep, yeah. Alaris was big. But a whole slew of other types of products in ophthalmology and diagnostic testing. GenProbe had gotten off the ground by then, which Ivor Royston was involved in as well. So, you know, by 1999, we were, I think, just kind of on the brink of really becoming well-known as a biotech cluster here.
And did you have ideas about, you know, what needed to be done in order to promote this the right
yes.
way?
Yes, and when I came to Biocom, my idea was, so because I had been at Penwalt and Mycogen, one of the things that had almost become a part of my everyday life was working internationally. And, you know, at Mycogen, we had offices in Europe, in South America. We worked a lot in Australia and Japan, had Japanese partners. At Penwalt, you know, we had same thing, offices all over the place. And I spent even at Mycogen, I spent a lot of my time flying around the world to our various sites, working with folks, getting the regulatory approvals we needed through the European Union, working with the Argentinians and the Chileans, where we would grow seed in the opposite seasons that we have here, they have down there, so we could grow twice as much seed by taking advantage of places like Chile and Argentina.
Was Monsanto doing that too?
Monsanto was doing this. Everybody was doing that.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I came to Biocom, I thought, gee, one of the things I'd really like to do is to give this industry some global exposure. And so I came here with the idea that we needed to build this organization so that it would act as a real marketer for San Diego biotech. Now, fortunately, I had a great partner in Julie Meyer Wright, who ran the San Diego Economic Development Corporation at the time. She had been Pete Wilson's Secretary of Trade and Commerce when he was governor. And Pete had started a group called the Governor's Biotechnology Advisory Council back around 1993 or so. My boss, Jerry Calder, served on it, but Jerry used to send me to the meetings because he felt that I had the experience dealing with government folks, and so I'd go up and sit in these meetings that Julie would run for Pete, and we'd talk about things like how could the state help to grow the biotechnology industry, what was the industry shaping up to look like, and when Pete served his two terms and retired, Julie came down here to run the EDC, and Julie and I began to work together from the start to create presentation that we began to give to folks here and outside of San Diego that we titled the Ecosystem San Diego, the Life Science Ecosystem of Innovation. And our first big opportunity came when in 2000 the Biotechnology Industry Organization decided that it would have its annual conference in 2001 in San Diego. Now, BIO itself started the conference back in 1994, and its predecessor had had a couple of small get-togethers in San Diego, but this conference had grown to become a big international conference by that point. And BIO decided to have it here in 2001. And so one of my first tasks right out of the gate was to work with the Biocom board and with the industry in San Diego to make sure that we took advantage of this convention as an opportunity to really showcase what was happening here in biotech. So that was a big part of the goal. And and Julie and the EDC were great partners. And another goal was to begin to establish a presence, more of a presence in Sacramento, where we had built relationships through the Governor's Biotechnology Council. And in Washington, because the concern that I had and our board leadership had was that while BIO was a great organization in Washington representing the industry, we felt that we needed our own representation as a San Diego biotech industry.
Was there any way that interests weren't completely aligned there, or you felt it was important to get San Diego to, you know, get some face time for San Diego specifically?
We felt that our local legislators, our members of Congress, should have the interaction with our local biotech industry in Washington, and that they could help to drive a lot. Now, we'd also had some experience in that regard because when Lynn Schenck was a member of Congress from San Diego in 19. She only served one term from 1992 to 1994, but she was largely responsible for the passage of the Prescription Drug User Fee Act, the first Prescription Drug User Fee Act. Mm-hmm. So that was largely through relationships that companies here in San Diego had with Lynn. So we thought that it was important to kind of continue having that kind of relationship and having a presence in D.C., which, you know, with an organization at that time. We only had six people on the staff, and our only public policy person was a person who dealt with City Hall for the most part. So one of the things that I began to do was to travel to Washington more. We had an assistant who had sent she was here when I got here, April Bailey, who had spent got her degree in poli-sci at San Diego State and spent a year as an intern on Capitol Hill. And I said, you're going to be the foundation of our Washington, D.C. program, April. Mm-hmm. let's figure it out.
So you felt she had the talent to do that.
She had the talent, she had the drive, and and she was here. She was at BioCom.
Mm-hmm.
We began to build that program. We began to do more to, largely beginning with a bioconference, to promote San Diego. I began to travel more to places around the country. I became engaged in a group called the Council of State Bioscience Associations that was sponsored by Bio. Moved into more of a leadership role there and began to travel around to the different state organizations and talk about what we were doing here in San Diego. It began to pay off. I mean, it began to pay off in the sense that we got more attention for what was happening here in San Diego. When I came here, there was one pharmaceutical company, Johnson & Johnson, that had a presence here. We began to see more pharmaceutical companies taking an interest in having a presence in San Diego. We would talk to these folks at conferences. We would invite them here.
Put them in touch to say, hey, you need to go to Scripps, Salk, UCSD.
And see what we've got going on here. Can we set up meetings for you? Can we bring folks into BioCom who you can talk to? It really, really began to work to get some exposure. And, and it began to pay off. So the other thing we began to realize at that time was that capital was still pretty scarce. And so we thought we should build some programs to help companies to raise investment capital. So we began to focus more on the venture world. We created a whole suite of sort of visiting offices for venture capitalists from out of town who might want to come to San Diego and spend a week, and we'd give them office space that they could work out of at BioCom. That paid off as well because in the end we got two or three venture firms that moved down to San Diego, Domain Ventures, Thomas McNerney up in the Bay Area, Sophie Nova came down here as well.
And these are people who had come into your offices?
Yep. And Domain, of course, still has its headquarters here, moved down from Orange County. The other thing that we realized was that we needed to continue to grow the talent base here as companies were evolving and maturing. What had at that point evolved into a pretty solid research and development cluster was still not yet a development and commercialization cluster. So one of the things that we began to focus on was what we still call creating the homegrown workforce, training people in manufacturing, training people in basic management, putting together programs that would help young CEOs and young executives to be mentored by more experienced CEOs and executives. Those programs continue now. We've got programs for scientists in management. We've got programs in that we helped to create at San Diego State, degree programs in regulatory affairs, programs that start out, one that started out as a two-year program at one of the community colleges and is now a four-year program because that community college is one of the first in the state to have been given approval to go to a four-year program, a degree program in fermentation engineering. So we've continued to try to keep pace with what the professional development needs are, the industry. Back by 2008 or so, when the economy began to turn and we saw a whole change in the focus of investing in biotech companies.
Venture capital just kind of evaporated, yeah?
Yeah, venture capital evaporated, and venture capital that was invested was being focused more on acquiring technologies and trying to get those technologies developed by experienced outside experts, not building companies with 300 or 400 people in them and building, you know, facilities that were monuments to the company.
And San Diego hadn't really had an anchor.
No, San Diego had not had an anchor. So what was great about that was a lot of people who had come out of biotech companies had a chance to work as experts, became contract researchers, and so a lot of the folks in these biotech companies were now, you know, in companies with no more than 25 or 50 people in them, because the investors didn't want to invest in creating these huge companies that would potentially be acquired, and what would you do with all the physical facility and all the people that you'd hired. Better to contract out and have experts do all of this work. So we began to focus more at that point on building the framework around the contract research community here in San Diego, and connecting companies with the best talent that existed, which is good for small companies because, you know, at that time and even today, you know, we've got 700 members today at Biocom. The majority of them are companies with 25 or 50 people. You know, if you try to spread across that number of companies, the ability to hire experts in every field at each company, they're just not out there. If you can find an experienced contract researcher who can go to work for 5, 10, 12 of these companies at one time, they can all benefit by that experience, you know, that's a much more successful way to do things. So we've been working a lot in that arena as well. And then the other thing that we realized was that these small companies, especially with the need to conserve capital, could benefit by a program that would allow them to purchase everything that they needed to run their companies successfully and supply their companies. If we could provide it on a discount through a large group purchasing program. So we created a separate for-profit entity within Biocom called the Biocom Purchasing Group that provides 35 different types of supplies and services under contract to our members.
To all members, and how many of them make purchases? What percentage would you say?
95%.
Yeah.
Take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
The largest contract is for laboratory supplies. The next largest is for office supplies. One of the larger ones that we created about 3 years ago is for healthcare benefits. And it essentially gives our small companies the ability to purchase at a discount level that only a large corporation would be able to negotiate. Mm-hmm. So that's been really successful for our members here in San Diego.
Yeah. And the inflection point for focusing on this kind of collective stuff and contract research, did you say 2008? Is that really?
Around 2008 would really be.
Or even before that had you gone? I mean, this is a conscious strategy at some point. We say, yeah, we're going to, and was it your thinking that, you know, maybe we got to give up the idea of building, you know, a Genentech here, or
that's always been a controversial topic in biotech in San Diego. At one point, a lot of us were wringing our hands about how we didn't have a Genentech here and asking, will we ever, and how, what's it going to take to have a Genentech here? You know, companies like Biogen IDEC, what was IDEC back in 1999, 2000, we thought would become the next Genentech or Genzyme, but they did kind of a reverse merger with Biogen and ended up shutting down here and moving to Boston. So there have been a couple of those, and you know, there's never been a successful evolution here of a biotech company to becoming the next Genentech. But on the flip side, the reason that that's not happening is that companies are being acquired because they're creating some very attractive science and technology. So they're getting to you know, mid-stage where they're in phase two clinical trials, and we've got every pharma company under the sun kind of watching what's going on here now with a presence here.
So it's just a recognition that the industry has gone in this direction. We have to go with it. And we can.
And we can, and it's okay. And what's great about it is that the folks who are selling these companies, the CEOs of these companies, and the shareholders are selling the companies, but the CEOs of these companies are, for the most part, going on starting new companies and bringing along their talented senior management teams and starting new companies. So, you know, we're I think that's okay. And it's creating the potential for new drugs to be developed, hopefully through the acquiring companies. But the landscape's changed a lot here. You know, when I talked about the way it was back in the late 80s, early 90s, the biggest change today here is the presence of all of these pharmaceutical companies, whether it's, you know, Pfizer, Lilly, Celgene with large research facilities here, or AstraZeneca, which operates essentially through an acquisition that they made here of a biotech company.
What company was that?
It was not Acadia. I can't remember the name of the company now. You know, they've largely kept it intact. Then you've got Johnson & Johnson, which is just doing remarkably well with its J-Labs here, with 47 companies incubating within their J-Labs. Every model under the sun. You know, a couple of companies like Merck have had scouts here and nobody else. I think the two examples are Sanofi Aventis and Merck that have one or two people here. GlaxoSmithKline teamed up with Avalon Ventures and invested about $400 million in the creation of 10 new biotech companies here recently, and they've already created six with Avalon. So it's a much different landscape from what it was, and it's a different model than you see in places like Boston or San Francisco. Mm-hmm. The opportunity that these companies have to be a part of what's going on in biotech in San Diego, you know, is much different than what it was 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah, so does that make your activities more national, more global? The fact that, I mean, you're talking about, you know, AstraZeneca or whoever, you know, they could be anywhere, right?
So about 5 years ago, we created a brand new conference that's been growing every year that we call our Global Pharma Biotech Partnering Conference. And it takes place at the end of February each year. All of the major pharma companies send their licensing and business development people here, and even, you know, some of their very senior management people come to speak at this conference. And it's set up as a partnering conference between primarily our biotech companies in San Diego and the licensing folks at these at these large medical companies. So that's been a huge change.
I mean, yes.
And I think it's going to continue to happen as well. Other you know, the folks from Japan, we've got an office in Tokyo that we opened about 6 months ago. We've got 20 companies from Japan that are members of Biocom now. We think there are huge opportunities in Japan for San Diego, not only in terms of our companies entering the Japanese market, but in terms of bringing Japanese companies here to take advantage of the venture community that we have in California. Japan doesn't have much of a venture community, but their biotech industry is evolving pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. We do a lot in regenerative medicine here, of course. One of my other hats is that I sit on the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee for the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. You know, recently the grants that we've been approving have been for products that are going into later stage clinical trials and potentially commercialization. So that's a huge thing here for us in San Diego, and it's also
A lot of grants are coming down here?
A good number. I'd say about half the grants are coming down here, yeah. So it's a good split. One of our most advanced companies, Biosite, down here has been working with developing pancreatic stem cells that secrete insulin, and they've been able to insert them into a pouch that can be implanted under the skin and basically act as an artificial pancreas. And so we've got high hopes for Viacite becoming successful and getting that product approved. They're in late stage clinical trials now.
That could be huge. I mean, if they that could be Genentech. You know, diabetes is huge.
You know, people have asked me, so is this $3 billion that the state voters decided to invest in stem cell research worth it? And my answer is, if for $3 billion all that we get is an artificial pancreas, yeah, it's been successful. I think $3 billion is a pretty good investment in curing diabetes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed for Viacite being successful. But mm-hmm. all sorts of other areas, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, osteoarthritis that are coming into later stage trials now.
Yeah, all fascinating stuff. And speaking of Alzheimer's, I mean, what's your take on the dispute between UCSD and USC, and how does that impact, you know, I mean, you're talking to people working in the field. What does it mean for you?
Well, you know, first of all, it's unfortunate that there wasn't a more collaborative approach to how that study might be jointly managed by USC and UCSD. But, you know, this happens all the time. I mean, researchers are given better offers to go somewhere else, and they go. But I think the bigger question for us is, what is USC's end game? You know, about a year ago, they came very close to acquiring the Scripps Institution here. And fortunately, that was thwarted at the last minute. But I know, because I've been up there, Los Angeles wants to create a biotech community. They're actively working to create a biotech community. They've created a plan for a biotech community up there. They also have a good number of biotech companies in the Los Angeles area already. So Los Angeles is going to push hard and even harder to bring to LA the assets that they need to create a biotech community. Our strategy is to sit down with them and to say, look, we can do this in a way that we can both benefit, because we've got a lot of folks down in San Diego whom you could tap into and who are more than willing to do business up in Los Angeles to help them to build a biotech cluster up there. And we at Biocom, for the last 6 or 7 years, have referred to ourselves as the Southern California Life Science Association, which means for us that we've got members all the way up beyond Los Angeles ourselves as an organization. So we really think that there's a better opportunity if we work together to create one Southern California life science cluster that reaches from LA to San Diego than for these kinds of battles to go on. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be done, and I think if we do it successfully, LA will benefit and San Diego will benefit. You've got great research universities up there, UCLA, USC, some excellent biomedical research institutions up there, private institutes, a great base of investment capital up there, an international airport that we don't have here in San Diego, and people, you know, don't always believe that that's an important thing, but I can't tell you how many times I've been in places around the world talking biotech in San Diego where people have said to me, I can't fly directly to San Diego. I can't. There's no nonstop flight to San Diego. I can go to San Francisco. I can go to Los Angeles, but I can't fly nonstop to San Diego. Mm-hmm. So,
is that something you ever had conversations with the city about?
Oh,
is that
yeah.
just beyond the you know, the pale of?
There have been conversations, I understand, and I was on one of the airport planning committees. There have been conversations going back to 1950 about building a new airport in San Diego. None of those ideas have panned out for various reasons. The latest was to build an airport at what's now Miramar Marine Air Station. And the Marines said, we're not really interested in that idea. So that didn't go anywhere. There were plans at one point to put a binational airport down along the border. That didn't get anywhere. So right now there's no plan for an airport. The airport we have is being renovated and upgraded, but it's only being upgraded in terms of the number of gates and the facility. The runway isn't being changed. It's basically a short one runway airport. So you can't fly the jumbo jets in here. But fortunately, with some of the new planes like the 787, they can land here, and we could have nonstop flights out of here, out of that airport. So you know, there's an opportunity that we've got a nonstop flight every day between here and Tokyo now, which is helping us with some of the Japanese companies that we're trying to bring in.
Who's flying that?
Japan Airlines. So we've got about 20 or so new Biocom member companies from Japan. Mm-hmm. So that's, and I think part of the reason for that is, you know, in addition to the great partnering opportunities there are here, they can get here now.
Yeah. And so you're spending a lot of time up in L.A. talking to people?
A little bit of time.
Yeah. And who are you talking to? Who's really?
We're talking to the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. We're talking to the Economic Development Corporation. We're talking to their local biotech group. Essentially the folks who are at the core of trying to plan this.
And their local biotech group would be?
It's interestingly a group called Southern California Biomedical Council, but it's LA. Mm-hmm. And we're talking to some of our members up there too, folks at places like LA Biomed Research Institute and some of the companies up there. So. You know, we think there's an opportunity to expand up there and provide a lot of the services that we provide here to the companies that are up there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you talk a bit about the north-south split? I mean, Bay Bio just turned into, what is it, California Life Science?
That's an interesting name. They call themselves now the California Life Science Association. Yeah. We thought that was a very interesting choice of names for their organization. Look, I mean, San Francisco needs a life science association. I don't think San Francisco needs a California Life Science Association as much as they need a Bay Area Life Science Association. We had a very strong partnership with Bay Bio. We were sister organizations. Did a lot of the same things, worked in partnership on a lot of programs, and also mirrored each other on a lot of programs. I'm not sure that there's a reason to have a California Life Science Association when you've got a group, first of all, as strong as Biocom down here, with offices in Washington, D.C., with the California Biotechnology Foundation that we have up in Sacramento that works to educate the public and legislators throughout the state about the value of the biopharmaceutical industry here. It's a curious, to me, it's kind of a curious endeavor that and I think our board as well, questions in terms of what the end game is there. It's not the California Life Science Association, because you got an entity here, Biocom, that's celebrating its 20th year as the advocacy organization for San Diego and Southern California. It's not the San Francisco Biotech Association, so companies up there suffer by not having a Biocom that they can go to in San Francisco. So it's not a north-south split. It would be nice if it was a north-south split, because the north-south split that we had with Bay Bio functioned very well. It wasn't a north-south split. It was a north-south partnership. I'd like to try to go back to that. I think that would be a lot more successful of a model than the California Life Science Association and Biocom. I don't see those two as being reciprocal in most ways.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you to look back over the, you know, this is from 1999 through the present, locally with San Diego and maybe some of these other places. Carlsbad's got a lot of stuff going on, right?
Right.
And, but working with people locally in government, and maybe if you could talk about some of those people, and maybe how, you know, has it changed a lot over time? As you know, what have the policies been? Have they been troubled? And those sorts of issues, and also Sacramento too, but you know, locally here, and then working with. What kind of grades would you give?
I think I'd give. Locally, I think the grade I would give would be somewhere between a B-plus and an A-minus. Going back to my time here, our mayor, when I came to Biocom, was Susan Golding. She was a great supporter of the biotech industry. Within city government back at that time, we created a biotech economic assessment team that would help with things like basic things like expediting the approval of permits to build biotech labs here.
Did you have problems with that when you came to Mycogen?
We had a classic problem at Mycogen. You know, as I said, Mycogen was an agricultural biotech company located in the heart of the biotech cluster here. So the difference, of course, with Mycogen was we were working with seeds and plants and crops and things like that. So we needed a research greenhouse back in the early 90s. And we wanted to put the research greenhouse right out behind the laboratory at Mycogen. So I went to the city with a permit application to construct a greenhouse. And the city permitting department responded, we could not build a greenhouse because you can only build greenhouses in zones in areas that are zoned for agriculture. And this was zoned for laboratory research. And we said, well, no, but it's a laboratory research greenhouse. They didn't understand what that meant. They'd never seen anything like that before. Mm-hmm. We eventually got it approved. but it took a long time before the city kind of came around and began to work more with us. And we would go down and make presentations and sit around the table with Mayor Golding with all of our biotech executives to inform her more about what was happening in the industry here. Our County Board of Supervisors was also very engaged in wanting to understand what we would need to be able to grow here. Basic stuff like when I was running the facilities group at Micogen, they came to me one day and they said, we can't get our laboratory approved by the fire warden because we've got too many chemicals. The city only allows a certain number of chemicals in a laboratory. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, they're more focused on 55-gallon drums than pint bottles. And, you know, we've got 100 pint bottles instead of 5 55-gallon drums, and they don't know how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. So we had to change basic stuff like that. So I think the good thing is that all of our mayors, from Susan Golding to Dick Murphy to Jerry Sanders, even Bob Filner for the time that he was mayor, and now Kevin Faulkner's just been fantastic, have been our partners in ensuring that we've got the kind of environment we need. One of the things I think that we could do better here, and I've talked to city government and county government more, is to create more in the way of tax incentives and even possibly some investment in the biotech industry here. County pension fund, for example, is a very large and well sustained pension fund that could invest in biotech very easily here, and it doesn't have to be in the most risky biotech either. So I give them a good B+ or A-. Sacramento, we spend more time in Sacramento killing legislation that could potentially be harmful to us.
For example? Has this always been true?
Been true for as long as I can remember. Initiatives to require labeling of genetically modified foods.
That doesn't really impact San Diego that much.
No, it doesn't, but it impacts the industry from the standpoint that it casts a negative shadow on biotech in general. So, mm-hmm. you know, we're all in the same pond. Legislation that is more focused on some of the environmental challenges around building biotech facilities, making it more difficult to get approval to build manufacturing facilities here. And at the same time, you know, I think under this governor in particular, we've had at least one big success working with the legislature and with him that gives biotech companies an exemption from the state sales tax on the purchase of research and manufacturing equipment. For large companies, that's a big help, and even for some small companies. But I think Sacramento, our local legislators and some of the folks up in the Bay Area, you know, the 120 legislators in the Assembly and the Senate, a fraction of those folks work with us day in and day out and know us and understand the industry. A lot of them don't understand the value of the industry. We've, I think, made some headway with the governor's office relative to them gaining more of an appreciation of the value of the industry here. And the importance of the state investing in the industry here. You know, you realize that you point to the Stem Cell Initiative and $3 billion. That wasn't an initiative of the legislature or the governor. That was a citizens' initiative that the voters passed to fund stem cell research. My guess is we could never have gotten a legislature to pass something like that. Mm-hmm. So, but we should. We you know. When I started at Biocom in 1999, you know, the U.S. was it when it came to biotech. That's not true anymore. China's making huge investments in biotech. And, you know, we had, for 3 years, Biocom had a program in China trying to look for opportunities to take advantage of the Chinese market.
Yeah.
We decided that patent protection wasn't there and that their regulatory approval process wasn't mature enough yet, and at the same time that their business practices weren't well evolved yet. So
corruption problems?
Yeah, all kinds of things like that. Just
Wild West.
Wild West, yeah. But at the same time, they've thrown a lot of money at creating a biotech industry in China. And we're seeing, you know, other areas that are becoming competitive. Japan, under Prime Minister Abe, who's made biotech a priority in Japan as well. Things are beginning to happen in some places in Europe. We spent a lot of time in southern France looking at what's happening with their biotech industry there.
Southern France,
I believe. Marseille, Nice.
Really?
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that before. What's going on?
There's a lot of investment being made, especially in the Marseille area, in companies in immunology and cancer diagnostics and cancer for the most part.
Hmm.
And some of those are becoming pretty successful companies.
Look into that.
Yeah. It's not just a nice place to go on a visit. But, you know, I say to people all the time, I don't need to go to southern France to experience nice weather and the ocean. We've got it here. So
mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of competition that we're beginning to see that's cropping up now. So
this is something, when you started here, that wasn't so much.
No.
But now, yeah, okay.
No. We're seeing that a lot more. And I think we also have to appreciate the fact that Massachusetts has made a huge effort the last few years to attract companies and talent to Massachusetts. We can't take for granted the fact that we've got the largest biotech industry in the country and in the world in California, because other people are beginning to grow their industries and attract companies and people from here. So I think the state, I would say that I'd give the state probably a B minus in biotech. I think there's a lot of work to be done there.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been steering the ship here for you know, I don't know, 15, 16 years.
Yep.
I don't know how long you plan to carry on with it, but, you know, looking forward, where's this going? What are the opportunities? What are the challenges?
Well, we're in the middle of working with our members to create a 5-year plan for life science in Southern California. It's our 2020 plan. In our 20th year, we're working on our 2020 plan. And that plan's going to be a lot different from other strategic plans that we've done here. And we've always, from the day that I got here, relied on our strategic planning process to help to direct us toward where we want to be. We think that 5 years from now, San Diego can be the global capital for personalized medicine, big data analytics in biotech and digital and electronic health. And our strategic planning process is focused on how we continue to build the infrastructure here as San Diego to get there in 2020, to be able to say in 2020 we are the capital of personalized medicine. And
what do you need to do that?
Well, we need to continue to grow the resources that we have here, the companies like Illumina that we need to keep here. We need to grow the fledgling companies that are being created in all of those areas, the digital health companies, the big data companies. We need to continue to develop the talent base, the different talent base that goes into growing those companies than goes into the traditional biotech type of company that we've had here in the past. We need computer scientists, computer engineers, folks who understand the crossroads of electronics and computing and medical devices and therapeutics. We need to bring that talent here more. We need to interface with folks in Japan, the Panasonics and Toshibas and Hitachis that are moving into that arena. And just as we brought the large pharma companies here, we need to bring the Toshibas and Panasonics to San Diego as well.
So when you talk about opportunities in Japan, is this principally what you have in mind, this sort of future looking at, you know, this convergence of IT?
Yep. That's part of it. The other part of it is, we brought on our first board member from Japan this past year. He runs a company called NF Corporation that's a high-level electronics company that focuses on developing equipment for laboratory testing. We just had a conversation with Takagawa Electric Company the other day that just recently created a life science division with some very high-end imaging equipment, cellular imaging equipment that they've developed. So part of it is the digital health side in Japan. Part of it is regenerative medicine and biotech. And a big part of it is the fact that a lot of the electronics companies in Japan are moving into biotech more.
Yeah. Well, what's San Diego's competitive position? I mean, you're talking about personalized medicine and electronics, IT, and so on. I mean, you have to compete with Silicon Valley.
And Silicon Valley, you know, the Googles and Yahoos and Amazons and are all creating life science businesses.
Right.
You know, some of our companies actually have partnerships with Google's life science group. So I think we have to also find ways to get them down here. So the attractiveness, I think, here versus places like the Bay Area and Boston is that no plan that we put together, we've got a successful telecommunications sector down here. We've got a successful electronics sector, and we've got these areas of high tech that are beginning to converge with the biotech industry, the medical device cluster that we have, that other places don't have. So I think there's an attractiveness here in the fact that we've got all the basic elements that it takes to go forward to create the new era of personalized medicine and digital health that you don't have in other places.
Mm-hmm. And the academic institutions, the research institutions locally, are they assisting you with this? And what's their role? Do they see a role for what they're doing fitting into this? But I'm just thinking, I don't know if he's still there. Topol, is he still at Scripps? He's like a personalized medicine guy.
He's kind of leading the charge on digital health as both a researcher and a spokesman. So the reason that we moved into this new Biocom office that we're sitting in is that we wanted to be close to the research institutes and the university. Because we see a growing partnership between the industry, the research institutes, and the university. Perry Neeson, who's just come over in the last year to run the Sanford Burnham Prebys Institute, led their efforts at Glaxo to develop drugs around the world. His reason for being here is to do more to interface what's being done in research and development at the Sanford Burnham Institute with the industry here, and hopefully to create more products. And I think Salk has a reputation, a long-time reputation, for scientists kind of having one foot within the Salk and one foot within industry. And so I think
more so than Scripps or UCSD?
Scripps, I'll talk about UCSD in a minute, but Scripps, I think, was also partnered with some specific companies here, like Pfizer. But I think, for the future, Scripps is going to have to kind of figure out where it's going to go. UCSD is making a remarkable effort Now, under the current chancellor, Pradeep Khosla, the vice chancellor for research, Sandra Brown, some of the deans in the School of Pharmaceutical Sciences and Engineering and Bioengineering, to connect more with the local community. And part of the UCSD's challenge has always been that they've had a very bureaucratic tech transfer office. So people don't tend to typically want to try to work with them because it's frustrating to do deals with them. But they've just created a new position, an associate vice chancellor for industry relations, who's one of his jobs is going to be to fix the tech transfer office. And we're going to do everything we can to help to make that happen, because UCSD is just a powerhouse of biomedical research that we could take more advantage of here if we had a closer relationship with them. And that hasn't been the case in the past. So I think the chancellor talks about how many biotech companies were created out of UCSD. And I think, you know, to a large extent, he's right. Scientists left UCSD and took their intellectual property and went and created biotech companies. We need to have that partnership between the university and the industry and get beyond scientists leaving and starting companies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to begin to see that happen.
Yeah. They did have Connect, right? Was it Connect was trying to do some of that bridging, weren't they?
Yeah, and Connect is getting back to its roots these days. So Connect used to be a part of UCSD, and initially Connect's responsibility was to work with areas like tech transfer and scientists coming out of the university, helping them to get their companies off the ground, understanding how to get funding and manage companies and things like that. About 10 years ago, Connect divested itself from the university, became an independent entity, began to grow in other areas and create other programs. And
what sort of stuff was going on?
Focusing on areas like began to focus on areas like trying to work more with the biotech industry, where Connect's initial focus had been on the technology industries in San Diego.
Because that was where Dwayne Roth was coming from?
Yeah, and I don't fault Dwayne for it, because that was Dwayne's background. Dwayne realized, I think, that to build the kind of organization that he wanted to build, he would have to get it out of UCSD to get the kind of funding that he needed from folks like Qualcomm and others. They created a Washington, D.C. office. That's great if you're Qualcomm and a couple of other companies. Most three-person companies don't really need a Washington, D.C. office. So I think Connect is kind of getting back to basics now under Greg McKee. And, I think Dwayne raised the image of San Diego and the image of Connect within the community, which was great. I think Connect is kind of retreating back in a positive way to working with the university, working with the tech transfer office, and getting back to doing what it was originally created to do when Bill Otterson created it.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else we should know, Joe? Anything else we should cover as part of this? Is your...
I don't think so.
Yeah,
I've been trying to think as we've gone along here what we've left out, but I think we've been pretty thorough.
Mm-hmm.
I just think, you know, when you think about where we've come from as an association, as a biotech cluster here, where we are today, and where we have the opportunity to be 5 years from now, I think we've come from relative obscurity to a high level of awareness of who we are, to potentially 5 years from now being the global leader, and not in the traditional way. So if you look at all these surveys that come out year after year after year over, you know, where's the largest biotech cluster? Which cluster has the greatest number of companies? Which cluster has the greatest number of employees? Which cluster has the highest amount of financing? you know, that's the way that, that clusters have been ranked up to now. I think this cluster has the opportunity 5 years from now to be number one, not so much because it has more companies or more employees or more financing, but because it's moving in the direction of being at the forefront of biomedical research and development commercialization with the powerhouse that we've got here of technologies. So I'm thinking that 5 years from now we'll, and I plan to be here 5 years from now because I want to see out this 5-year strategic plan, I think 5 years from now we're gonna be very pleasantly surprised with where San Diego sits versus where it's been in the past.
Okay. We should come back in 5 years and just get your review of
the
strategic plan. And it's been a fun ride. I mean, it's a fascinating industry. Right?
Thank you. And yeah, thanks, Mark. Yeah. Enjoy it. It is a fascinating industry. It's you know, I've got to